I'm Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is True Crime New England. What's up, everybody?
Hello, welcome back to another episode.
Thank you for joining us on this beautiful Thursday morning.
We hope.
Yeah, whenever you be listening, we be here.
If it's a year from now, hello from the past.
How are we? How are we doing? Podcast-wise, mentally, physically? If you could give us some insight, that would be really great. But just let us know in a year or so, and we'll get back. You know, we'll talk about that later. But anywho, as we go along in our podcast, you know, now we're on episode 78, which is pretty crazy. We have this whole master list, as we've talked about before, and you guys who listen know about. And we have over 500 cases, I would say, on that list. And that includes the ones we've already covered. We do keep them. We don't delete them off the list. We just write that they were covered, whatever. I am noticing when I go through and I'm bored and it's slow at work or I'm just at home, the cases in Massachusetts are plentiful. The cases in New Hampshire are fairly plentiful. Even Connecticut, I feel comfortable with the amount of cases we have. Vermont, Rhode Island, and Maine even, they are getting lower and lower in terms of quantity. That's not to say that we don't want cases from Massachusetts or New Hampshire. Please send them our way. But we just have nothing for, truly Vermont is our lowest on the totem pole, which is surprising because you'd think Rhode Island.
Right.
Or even Maine. But those are our three lesser states of what we have available. So we are sending out another call to action.
Yes. Our last call to action for specifically Vermont cases was fairly successful.
Yeah.
We had, you know, really great people messaging us on Instagram.
Our email,
our website, using that handy dandy submission tool. You guys are probably so tired of hearing me talk about. But yeah. We would still love anything from Vermont.
Yes.
Rhode Island as well. You know, the littler guys. Mm-hmm. If it is in New England, though, and you want to hear us talk about it, please send it.
Just send it to us, please.
Just in New England would be great. You know, that is the whole premise of why we're doing what we're doing.
Right, and the title is kind of important.
Yeah.
You know, it's not True Crime New England plus a few. So we're sticking to our brand, but we're just struggling with Vermont, and it's maybe that's just to speak on the fact that Vermont, I think, is the safest state in America, which is wonderful. But if you could go out and commit some crimes for us, I would be honored. I would provide an alibi for you.
Before anyone does so, True Crime New England does not condone any kind of murder, crime, theft, burglary, assault,
breaking of the law of any kind. Ever. Don't do that. I was just making a joke. Ha ha. But for the sake of the podcast, sacrifices could be made so we could... No. Just kidding. So if you guys think of it, if you have somebody you know or, you know, your aunt told you the story one time of this old murder that happened in our town and it was in the 40s, whatever, send it to us. You know? It's our job to look into the amount of information there is, so... Just send it to us. We'll give it a look-sees, see what we can do. Obviously, we try and give our episodes some heft. You know, we have separate mini episodes for a reason, but we'll do whatever we can to get cases and stories and talk about these awful tales.
For sure. Today might be one of those cases where we have enough information. We don't have a ton of information. Mm-hmm. It might be not a super long episode, but it's still definitely very much worth checking out, especially mm-hmm. because it is still unsolved and we don't really know a whole lot about the murder, which I'm sure is very frustrating to the victim's family.
Yeah.
As well as us, because we love to know, you know, more information. The more information we can get out there about a cold case, the better. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some things are left unknown for various reasons, and we respect that, but today is an example of a case that is definitely lesser known.
Absolutely.
And it's a pretty good example of why we do episodes like this.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And it's, you know, it's tough doing research because we only have so many resources sometimes. And that's, you know, the whole premise of our case profiles, really. But this was a little hard to find some good research on. But nevertheless, we'll still talk about it because it is important. Mm. And like you said, it's unsolved. And I think that gives us even more reason to just kind of see what we can do.
For sure. As we just asked you to do a couple minutes ago, send us cases. Today's case was suggested to us by a lovely listener, Devlin, who kills it every time they come through with a suggestion. I mean, this has to be, what, the second or third case from me?
The third that they've sent, yeah.
But yeah, Devlin, you kill it every time with the recommendations. I mean, we go off of our master list, which has, like you said, Liz, well over 500 cases.
Yeah.
And we just, I guess, are drawn to the ones that you suggest.
Yeah, it's unintentional, but, I mean, you haven't failed us so far, Devlin, so thanks.
Yeah.
And there you go, guys. You know, if you're not Devlin, now you know, if you do give us a case and we like it, you'll get a little shout-out. Maybe even times three if you send us three good ones and we do them all.
Oh, yeah.
And we have so many still from Devlin waiting in the wings, so pretty awesome. We appreciate that, and just send us anything you got. And Devlin, again, thank you for this case, because it is pretty fascinating. A lot of mystery.
For sure.
And without further ado, today we will be covering the murder of Samantha Folsom. Katie, it does not matter the amount of sources that we have, or the lack thereof. I want to hear them from you right now. First, please.
I will do that for you.
Thank you.
And only for you.
Oh, stop.
The sources I have today are from WGME.com, Medium, which I cannot speak more highly of.
Love them.
The Portland Press Herald and TrueCrimeDaily.com.
I also use Medium.com, which again, love, 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 love. I use the Portland Press Herald, Dignity Memorial, which was kind of like a find a grave situation. And then I also used an article written on Morbidology, which is a podcast, but they don't have an episode covering her. I think it's just like a blog post. It was really well done. So I got a lot of my information from there.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about Samantha Folsom, or as she was born, Samantha Turner. She was born on February 6th, 1985 in Little Rock, Arkansas, to her parents Jolene and John David Turner. She moved to Maine fairly young. She had family in Maine, so they came here, you know, when she was young, and it was her mom, her dad, her, and her brother Jonathan, who was older than her, and they seemed like they were just the best of friends. That's a special bond you don't always get at all.
Absolutely.
Speaking from personal experience, I am not close to my brother, and she and Jonathan were just besties. They did everything together.
Oh my God. It was reading different articles, especially her parents' accounts of them growing up together, was precious.
Yeah.
Because she would beg and plead to go with Jonathan to everything. I mean, she went with him to Boy Scouts.
Yeah. She probably was part of the troop at that point.
Yeah.
Which is so sweet. It's very sweet. So it's nice that they had that bond. I'm sure that was a very positive aspect of her upbringing. Together, they loved to swim and do karate and play soccer and go camping. And, you know, like you said, the Boy Scout meetings, and very much involved with each other and the activities that they both took place in. Like, she was a soccer player and a swimmer. And, like, she just was a very active girl, it sounds like. And her and Jonathan just bonded over all of that, and they just were so close. So, which is wonderful. I'm very jealous, you know. It'd be nice to have a nice relationship with your sibling. I'm sure a lot of people can't say that they do like that. So, in 1990, so she was about 5 years old, they moved to Green, Maine, and that's where she ended up growing up. And like I said, she did a whole bunch of sports. She was very smart and known to be very friendly, and picking up the underdog was a phrase used quite a bit. in all of the articles I read was that she was known to be a friend of everyone, which is wonderful. That's hard to tolerate every person.
Oh my God. Jesus Christ. I know, especially with people these days.
I know.
In high school, Samantha was the captain of the junior varsity cheerleading team, and she also played soccer and was a very talented swimmer.
Awesome.
Like you said, Liz, she would always stand up for people. It seemed like what I gathered is that if she saw someone who's having a hard time or maybe sitting by themselves at the lunch table, she would go, hey, do you want to come sit with us? Or, you know, it's really hard, especially in a school setting, I think when you're a kid, to kind of fit in with everybody. And, you know, peer pressure is awful and just bullying. And it seemed like she didn't really get caught up in any of that at all.
Mm-hmm.
She just loved people. And she loved to make sure everybody was doing okay. And she also, it seemed like she was someone that was part of a lot of different groups or different cliques. So she kind of just meshed well with everybody.
Which is awesome. And that's actually like, you know, obviously everyone has their own experiences in high school and stuff. But she seems like she just was there for everyone. And that's not something that you can say about a lot of people. Middle school, high school is very cliquey, just naturally. So the fact that she wasn't a part of anything says a lot about her character.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we're like really hyping her up, but she sounded like such a very, like such a wonderful person. And all the people who spoke on her behalf saying like how she was, only positive things, you know, wonderful daughter, great student. She loved animals and she was all this wonderful stuff. So, which is true, she loved animals, which I relate to. And I thought it was so funny because she is described as being super in love with animals and owned, quote, many cats. And I thought that was pretty relatable because I own many pets and I want to be known as someone. I want to be remembered. She loved animals and had many cats. She had many rabbits, whatever. So she loved animals. I mean, who among us? And specifically cats. And her first cat was named Moo Moo. And the article that I was reading from, it was like 2012, 2013. And that cat was still alive at that point and was 20. So she was old and, oh, so sad to like outlive your owner. Oh, I just don't like that. She also, in typical teenager fashion, loved music. She loved rap. Her favorite rap group was the Insane Clown Posse, which are scary people, but that's just because they make it so they're intimidating. But she also was known to just love any kind of music, like her parents' disco music. She was just always jamming. So she just sounds like an all-around good person. And I will keep hyping her up because she sounded wonderful.
Samantha, soon after high school, met a man named Jesse Folsom. Sam's mom, Jolene, had kind of a gut feeling that he wasn't a great guy. She still tried to accept him into their family because this was someone that their daughter loved. You know, so they're trying to be good parents and they're trying to, well, you know, he doesn't seem like the best person for you and you're our daughter and we love you so much. But if this is a man that you love, we're going to do our best to accept him with open arms.
Right. Which I think is a really nice gesture.
Yeah.
How they met and fell in love is pretty cute, in my opinion. So it was right after Samantha graduated high school, and she was set up on a blind date with her friend set her up. And so their first date was at this pool hall in Lewiston, Maine, called, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Shemengi's. It was just like a pool hall, casual, and according to like friends and stuff, it like was a few weeks before they were officially a couple and like totally into each other, you know, typical young love.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesse kind of was, not much is known about like his childhood or whatever, but it sounds like where the story picks up when he meets Samantha, he was going through it a little bit. Samantha had graduated high school. And Jesse would have been a year younger than her in school, and he did not graduate. And he just was struggling, it sounds, for whatever reason. And I think that was also kind of a red flag for Samantha's parents, maybe. And that also was giving them negative vibes, but they still tried their best to accept him, and they even helped him a lot.
Samantha's parents helped Jesse turn his life around. Like you said, Liz, he had never graduated from high school officially.
Yeah.
So they helped him get his GED. Samantha's father would actually spend a lot of nights after work with Jesse, helping him practice and answer questions and just kind of study for the GED exam, which I think is really nice.
Yeah.
Like, bent over the kitchen table at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, over a shared book between them, and just kind of making sure that Jesse was going to do it, and he was going to get his GED, and he was going to turn his life around. Jolene, at one point, noticed bruising on Samantha's arms. Actually, it was at several different times that she noticed this bruising. Samantha was pretty adamant that it wasn't anything to do with Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
Her mom had a gut feeling otherwise.
Yeah.
Samantha's parents also helped Jesse enroll in the army because, you know, that's a good way to get your life together. And once you get out, you can have housing and a bunch of other benefits. So,
right.
I mean, it was something that he was interested in. So they helped make it happen.
Great.
In December of 2005, Samantha and Jesse were married and they moved to California, where Jesse was actually stationed for the army.
Yep. So they moved to Fort Irwin, which was in Barstow, California. And I mean, I think it's a good move to join the army if you're struggling with even like things like motivation or like career, anything. It's a good move. And so it seemed as though Samantha was happy to move out there with him, obviously. And, you know, it was all fine and good. And, you know, in the end, she ended up liking California more than she liked Maine, which I could see that. but so they were fairly happy out there, and they lived out there for a while because that was where Jesse was stationed, like you said. And they, you know, they made friends. They had a house. There was military cookouts, and they were near Las Vegas, so they could go to Las Vegas on the weekend or whatever, you know, and have a good time. So it was just a nice change for them until it wasn't.
Samantha began to change, it seemed like, almost pretty shortly after their marriage. She seemed depressed. She seemed a lot more tired than usual and just all the time tired.
Yeah.
Her bright affect and just her bubbly personality and everything that made her so loving and like such a good person to be around.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like everything about her, all of her traits, everything about her personality was just very dull.
Yeah.
Her mom soon accused her of being on drugs.
Oh, yeah.
After a couple of different times of her mom mentioning it, like, you know, this is not like you. You're not acting like yourself. Are you on drugs? Are you taking anything? Finally, after a little bit of prompting, Samantha finally confessed that she was.
Yeah.
She said she was working to get clean, but I mean, obviously that shit is not easy.
No, no, no.
Especially because Sam was using heroin specifically.
Yeah.
Which is the definition of not easy to stop using.
No, that is terrible and very difficult to kick that addiction specifically. I mean, they're all terrible and it's a very hard thing to do, but heroin is brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, she and Jesse were using it. So they were kind of feeding off each other, which is, a lot of those relationships of people who use drugs together, they're not good relationships. They're toxic in other ways as well. So, you know, she started using drugs in California, and she did. She told her mom, I'm going to kick it. I'm going to, you know, I will get done. But a lot of people who have addictions say that, and it takes a few times for them to get it. Sometimes it doesn't stick at all, and that's the horror of addiction. So she was struggling with that quite a bit. That being said, though, she did feel more at home in California, so she didn't necessarily want to go back to Maine, although it sounds like maybe whoever was in California or they met was the source of like their heroin use. So I think that's probably why she wanted to stay there. That's me speculating, though, but it just seems logical because that's where it started. And unfortunately, this addiction went on for some time, and she tried several times to kick the habit. And, you know, a part of rehab with addiction is sometimes you're able to kick it for months or years at a time, and relapse is an unfortunately common aspect of that. So I believe she had a few slip-ups, and that happens, and that's part of recovery, but she definitely struggled with that until the day she died, for sure.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if Jesse as well was also pursuing getting clean and going to rehab, and, you know, maybe he didn't necessarily have the resources or the family support. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's kind of hard too. I mean, I can't speak for Jesse and his journey in getting clean.
Right.
But I am just wondering if maybe Samantha was, you know, I'm going to get clean, I'm going to do it. And then she would come home from rehab. And if Jesse was still using, or if he wasn't in the same mindset as her,
yeah,
like, oh, it's time to get clean, we're going to do it now instead of tomorrow or next week or next month, we're doing it today.
Right.
If he's not in that same mindset and that's who you're living with, that's who you're spending time with, that's your person. I mean, you're married.
Right.
That's going to be very hard to remain clean if one person is actively trying and another person is still using.
That is that's a very good point. That's difficult because you're right. If you love someone and you go and you get better for yourself and you come home and they're not getting better for yourself, but you love them, like, it's hard to leave. You don't want to leave. You want them to get better. So I feel like a lot of their relationship during this time was strained due to that. And also just drug use is straining regardless. Especially when you don't have access to it or you run low and you're withdrawing, and just, it causes a lot of problems just in every factor of life.
Sam and Jesse had been married for 3 years when on a trip back to Maine to visit her parents, Samantha was brought to the emergency room for abdominal pain. Upon closer examination in the ER, she found out she was pregnant.
And I wish there was more information on this part for me, mostly because I am a postpartum nurse, but I just was curious, abdominal pain, how early in her pregnancy, that's pretty not good, you know? Like, what happened to the... I just was curious, but not a lot is known, just that they found out she was pregnant.
Yes.
In Maine. But they still were living in California.
They also still were using heroin.
Yes.
Samantha and Jesse were both very excited. I mean, they were thrilled. Their relationship in itself was strained. Mm-hmm. Samantha was still trying to make steps towards her recovery and use heroin less, and then eventually not at all.
Right.
So she was working on herself, and this was just a really exciting milestone for both of them, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they've been married for 3 years. They're settled. They have a house. They're doing pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they were just really excited. And in June of 2008, Samantha gave birth to a lovely baby boy.
Yeah. His name was Darren, and I feel like, you know, she was hopeful that that would, A, keep her and Jesse kind of together, and then, B, maybe help her kick the habit and the addiction, because she's got this beautiful little boy now, and maybe that would help Jesse make that move as well, which is, you know, a lot of parents feel that way, which is, you know, kids are very important, and that's a great motivator. Unfortunately, the struggle was still going on, and that can be expected because of how brutal heroin is and addiction in general. So there's no doubt that they love their son. They just had struggles. So while Darren was born in California, shortly after he was born, like, I want to say like a year or so, they moved back to Maine. And Samantha was kind of reluctant to move back because she really liked California. But she came back, and, you know, initially Sam, Jesse, and Darren lived with Sam's parents in Green, Maine. They lived with the Turners, and it seemed like all right, but then the marriage just kept getting worse and worse, and eventually Sam ended up moving out on her own into, I believe, her apartment in Lewiston. So she kind of got her own space, and the couple was separated, although they were never officially divorced. So they just were going on their own paths, and I think, again, I don't know about what Jesse wanted, if he was trying to be free of drugs, if he was still struggling, whatever, but she had goals in mind that she wanted to get clean.
Her apartment was on Oxford Street in Lewiston, Maine, like you said, and once she started to get settled in and, you know, she felt like she was able to call this apartment home, even though she was reluctant to be in Maine versus in California.
Right.
She was starting to get settled, and she asked her parents. She said, you know, I know I've tried in the past. I know this won't be my first venture with rehab.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be clean for my son.
Yeah.
I have a son to raise. Jesse and I are separated, but we're still co-parenting pretty well. And I feel like I would just be a better parent if I were clean and I could focus on caring for my son. as opposed to focusing on heroin.
Which is, the fact that she could recognize that is so important. That's like the first step, because that is how your mind is so altered. But she loved her son. She wanted to do what was best for him, and that was give him a clean, sober mom. So she was giving it her all. Giving it her all with addiction comes those relapse periods, but she was still trying, which I think is very important.
Samantha's parents ended up taking custody of her son, Darren, so that Samantha could get clean.
Mm-hmm.
They were willing to help her in any way. They realized, you know, of course we can't just let our daughter be a heroin addict. If right. we're able to help her in any way and she wants to get help, of course we're going to do what we can. We're her parents.
Right. And I'm sure they were happy to have their grandson all the time.
Of course.
He's a cutie. He was a cute little guy.
Oh, little sweetie pie.
Yeah.
On November 6th, 2011, Samantha's parents, as well as Samantha, agreed to let a close relative watch the child so that Samantha's parents could take her to rehab for her appointment the next day.
Great step. I'm sure it sounded like, according to Jolene and John later in interviews, that she was very hopeful. And she seemed like she was determined that this time was it. And she was going to do it. And she was going to come home clean and be there for Darren. She really thought that. Like, she was really hopeful. And I think, you know, her parents were really believing it too. So they were hopeful. And it was going to be the start of something beautiful.
The day for Samantha to go to rehab, which would have been November 7th, 2011, they had plans. They were going to take her to rehab,
mm-hmm.
of course.
They were going to drive her.
Right.
Yeah.
She stopped answering her phone. Just completely MIA.
Mm-hmm.
They showed up at her apartment. They're knocking on her door. Hey, did you oversleep? We're here to...
Yeah.
They're not answering your phone, so we're here to take you to rehab like we agreed.
Yeah.
Darren's with a close relative. Come on out. We're going to go to rehab. You can do it. Everything's going to be fine.
Yeah. Just
get in the car. And that's the hardest step is to get in the car and go and walk through the doors. We're going to be right there with you. And they're outside her door.
Yeah.
And she's not answering the door.
Mm.
Not answering her phone. And at this point, they're blowing up her phone. They're practically banging her door down.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they were a little frustrated thinking, you know, you were so hopeful.
Yeah.
We made all these plans.
What happened?
This was the time. We're here to take you. Where are you?
Yeah. So naturally, they were getting concerned. And I bet you they probably were assuming the worst, like, oh, she's probably doing heroin right now. Or she's out somewhere getting a fix. And maybe they weren't wrong about that, because that... getting in your head and thinking, oh, I'm going to rehab, I'm never going to have heroin again, can make people be like, well, I might as well do it one more time, and then it just doesn't stop.
The amount of times that's happened, I mean, I worked at a psych hospital, we had an adult unit where we did do detox,
mm-hmm.
and we would find drug paraphernalia outside in the parking lot.
Oh, yeah.
Because they would do it in their ride. They'd sit in the parking lot, or their ride would drop them off, and they would stand outside or go in the woods or something.
Yeah.
Use one more time just to... Or maybe even two, it's easier to face that kind of obstacle when you're high.
When you're high. That's a good point.
It's easier to walk in the doors of rehab and get clean
mm-hmm.
when you're high.
It's true.
Some people do that. I mean, it's not uncommon.
No.
So we don't know if that's what Samantha did, but her conversation with her parents on the 6th to kind of arrange things, mm-hmm. that was the last time she was ever heard from.
Right. So that was puzzling. And like I said, she seemed in real good spirits. So her parents were like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of confusing because one source said this, one said the other. But it sounds like they tried getting into her apartment and weren't allowed entry at first. It was cited as being because their names weren't on the lease.
Yeah.
It was just Samantha. So they were like, no, like, you don't understand. They probably were like, she's an addict. Like, we need to make sure she's, you know, safe. And the landlord would not let them in, which is stupid, in my opinion, but hey. And they were so worried. And then they were thinking maybe she went to rehab on her own, doesn't have her phone, is trying to stay away from her phone because that's where the influences are. Possible, definitely possible. And I feel like most rehabs, you can't have your cell phone. So maybe that's what, and they, I think, were trying really hard to rationalize mm-hmm. what was happening because they don't want to imagine that something terrible happened to their daughter. So they're really like calling her and calling her and calling her. and leaving voicemail after voicemail and just nothing. Not a single thing. And then after, I think it was 3 days or so, they were like, it took more time for them to get that door open. But finally they did it by telling the landlord, her cat is in there. We need to make sure that he's fed. And so I guess the landlord was a cat lover because they were let in, finally.
3 days later, on November 9th. Ridiculous. 3 days.
It's ridiculous.
Samantha's mom actually stated in a later interview, quote, we had a really bad feeling even before we left the house. I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I'm sure that her anxiety and just her thoughts are probably racing, thinking, what's going on with my daughter? But that day specifically, on November 9th, on their way to the apartment,
yeah,
she just had a really bad gut feeling.
Mom's instinct, I'm sure. And as soon as they got there and unlocked the door and all that, they were immediately met with a very odd scene. Like we said, it's November, the beginning of November. And when they walk in, all like a ton of her windows are open. Not so weird. I'm someone who runs hot. I have windows open at weird times of the year. But also she had fans going, like more than one fan going. So it was very cold. When they walked in, it was chilly. Lights were on. The TV was on and it was loud. So they get in there and they're like, this is not someone who just left for rehab. This is not someone who's closing down their apartment for a few weeks or a few months, however, whatever. This is someone who something happened.
Right. And Samantha's cat, Gadget, was very grateful to see Samantha's parents because that cat was very hungry.
He was starving, which scared them because then they see him and he comes out and he's like, oh my, you know, oh my God, probably rubbing up on their legs like, hi, hi. And then they realize like he's starving. So where is Samantha? I bet a part of them was still hoping that she was just in rehab herself. She got there herself. She didn't have her phone. She was in recovery and she just had to go in and get there and just left the cat, you know, whatever. I'm sure they were just trying to rationalize it because they don't want to, you don't want to think something bad happens to your child.
No.
Unfortunately, that's not the case with this story.
Samantha's mom opened the closet door to grab the cat carrier to take the cat Gadget. And that's when she found Samantha's body.
I can't even imagine. Just going like, well, Samantha's not here. Maybe this is typical of her, whatever. We'll take Gadget with us, make sure he's okay. And, you know, let me look in this closet. I think she has a cat carrier in here. Opens the door. And her eyes fall to the ground where her young daughter is laying in a fetal position with her head facing away from the door. And she's very clearly dead.
She had also very clearly been dead for at least a couple days.
Yes. Which is also interesting because, and we can talk about this in terms of theories and stuff, but it was really cold in her apartment. And if it was a closet, so that would have been cold anyway. So the body probably didn't decompose a whole bunch, but enough where obviously she's dead, which is pretty obvious. But it was immediately suspicious because the door was closed. And she was laying there. There was no... The reports for what happened after this is very vague, including, like, how she died and, you know, if she had any injuries. Literally anything regarding, like, an autopsy, anything like that, none of that's been released. Honestly, my first thought was, oh, she overdosed. And then I thought, the door was closed. That's magical. Maybe she locked herself in the closet. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that could be said, but it was like, this something's not right.
Something's immediately when they describe the scene or when I read about the scene, I'm thinking, you know, the windows are open and the fans are on full blast to help conceal the smell of decomposition.
Yep.
So that no one finds her for a longer period of time.
Right.
More time will go by before someone notices that she is decomposing inside of her apartment.
Right.
The TV being on full blast, perhaps concealing any noise from a murder being committed.
Yeah.
And maybe also the cat trying to alert people, scratching at the door.
Yeah, true.
Being a very hungry cat inside,
yeah,
looking for food.
That's a good point.
The cat would probably, if her cat is anything like mine, my cat will shriek and scream and beg for food. And she's not starving.
Right.
If this cat had not been fed for at least a couple days, I can imagine he would be making lots of noises inside the apartment.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. And like I said, unfortunately, to this day, it's unclear how Samantha died. I'm sure they know, they just don't, there's nothing out there to release it. And maybe that's a, you know, police tactic to kind of keep it close to the vest. But they were pretty suspicious as soon as they found her, though, because it was a locked closet. And I guess you could make an argument that maybe she did the heroin, then like curled up in the closet and closed the door, and then she died. You could even make the argument that the wind, with all the windows open, maybe she was in the closet and the door was open and then the wind shut it. You know, I've definitely had the wind shut my doors in my home, you know? So, like, that's definitely a possibility. And that would also maybe, you know, give explanation to why her TV was still on, why her lights were on, you know? But that's just a theory I have.
You guys' first thought about this is probably similar to what ours was, is where is Jesse, the father of her child, her recently separated partner, fellow heroin user, and potential abuser, given that Samantha has had bruises on her arms, at least visible to her mom.
Yeah.
Jesse was actually in jail at the time of Samantha's murder for assaulting Samantha's very new boyfriend.
Yikes.
Samantha's very new boyfriend, they actually had broken up almost right before Samantha's death.
Mm-hmm.
So that also looks very suspicious. Like, who's this new guy? The timeline is off. Oh, they had a breakup right before she passed away.
Yeah.
The new boyfriend didn't do it either because he was also in jail.
I think it was probably for the same thing.
It sounds like they both beat the shit out of each other.
Yeah. So they were in jail. In one of the articles I read, there was comments under it, and one person speculated, what if one of them hired a hitman? I guess that could be a possibility, but that was a pretty quick turnaround time because the fighting that got them both in jail was a few days before.
Right.
So from our experience of, you know, researching, it takes some time to find a hitman. It's not so easy to just be like, will you kill my wife for me for X amount of money?
Right.
I'll give you 10 pounds of heroin or whatever. That's kind of hard to convince someone to do that. So I don't buy that theory so much, but I mean, it is a theory.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good point. They're both in jail.
Right.
And it took a whole year until the police kind of were like, yeah, this is definitely a homicide versus just an accidental overdose or whatever happened, like a suicide maybe. They were like, yeah, no, this was homicide. And I wish they would tell us why they thought it was homicide.
Right. Exactly. I'm wondering, too, if maybe there were any visible indicators of a crime or anything on Samantha's body, or if they did have to do a toxicology report and see if something there was suspicious.
I'm sure they probably did anyway, just because she was a known user.
For sure.
I think you're probably right. Like, why would they keep it? What gave them the indication that it was homicide?
Exactly.
Like, she probably had track marks on her arm because she was a, you know, heroin user, but something pointed them in the direction where something funny turned up that wasn't just like heroin use.
For sure.
And I just want to know what it was.
Samantha's next door neighbor, Crystal Murphy, was interviewed by a reporter, and she said that detectives had asked her if she recognized a man, and they showed her a photo. He was well-dressed. He was wearing a button-up shirt and a tie. He had a darker, more olive kind of skin tone, and he was wearing some kind of ID badge around his neck. And Crystal said he looked like he had a position of authority.
Interesting.
Like, he was in authority. He was important. He was an important person in whatever he did in life or for work.
Okay.
She also said that a few days before Samantha was murdered, someone was knocking on Samantha's door and that Samantha seemed like she was very afraid of this person.
That's very interesting. And I wonder if it's a red herring and it really meant nothing, or it just, it's the guy. It's someone who killed her. It's such an interesting and unexplained situation.
Right. Or if these two guys that we're talking about, the one in the photo that's well-dressed and the one knocking on her door, if they're different people completely.
Right.
I mean, I'm wondering if the guy knocking on her door could have been a dealer that maybe she owed something to and she didn't want to confront him, especially if he was being aggressive.
Right.
And we also don't know who this guy is with the ID badge. We don't know anything else.
And why the police showed his picture to Crystal.
Right.
And I think we can make the assumption that it wasn't a picture of Jesse or her new boyfriend. So it's like, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Just to try and piece it together. Like, all of a sudden there's this third guy? Okay. Or potentially a fourth person?
Right.
Knocking on her door and scaring her? It's just a lot of unknown. It's very suspicious.
Samantha left behind her son Darren, who was 3 at the time of her murder, her loving parents, and her sweet cat Gadget.
Mm.
Anyone with any information on the murder of Samantha Folsom is asked to please call the Maine State Police. Their phone number is 1-800-228-0857. You could also call their other number. It is 207-657-3030.
And that is the very suspicious death, but most likely murder, of Samantha Folsom in Lewiston, Maine. A lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, sometimes with these cases, it just feels like there's never going to be answers.
And yeah,
we're just people on the outside wanting answers. I can't imagine how her family feels.
Oh, God, I know.
Especially her little boy, who's a teenager, young adult at this point, like 17, 18 maybe.
Yeah.
And he never got the chance to know his mom, you know?
I know. And I can't help but wonder, too, how her case was treated when it was first discovered that, oh, yeah, she was on her way to rehab and they found her curled up in the closet. She's a known heroin user.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with this? I mean, a lot of time when someone is a known drug user or an addict, mm-hmm. they are seen a little differently than someone who just died of unknown circumstances mm-hmm. that doesn't have a drug issue.
Right.
A lot of times people, especially law enforcement, kind of have maybe a preconceived notion of how something ended.
Right.
And they use maybe some potential bias to kind of fill in the blanks for them.
Absolutely. It's very similar to like sex workers mm-hmm. or, you know, people of color, children who have a history of running away.
Right. Right. A lot of times those cases are treated ever so slightly differently, if not majorly different yes. from,
yes,
you know, just a regular old
yeah.
suspicious death.
It's almost like the boy who cried wolf kind of thing. Like, oh, well, she did heroin. That was part of her life. And
right.
she was going to rehab and then she just did too much heroin. I don't know. I don't buy that one so much.
No.
Nope. Especially if a year later, the investigators were like, no, this was homicide. That means they were looking. I just want to know what they found.
I know.
Ugh. So this poor woman, her death is still unsolved, and it's been just now over 11 years. Awful. Very sad. Guys, please let us know what you think. Do you think she could have overdosed on her own and then maybe closed the door herself or the wind closed it? Do you think she was murdered? Do you think it was a hitman? What are your theories? Because there's a lot of room for speculation,
mm-hmm.
which, and a speculation isn't always like associated with great things, but just like maybe a new idea could pop up that's fresh and makes sense, you know? So you guys can find us on our social media at truecrimene,
all lowercase,
or you can send us an email at truecrimene@gmail.com.
You could also head over to our website. We have a page for this case. You can see some lovely photos of Samantha with her family, her cat Gadget, her beautiful son, Darren. I think right after she gave birth to him, there's a photo up on our website.
Yeah.
You could also go to our Contact Us page where you can send us questions, comments, your thoughts on this case, especially please, as well as others we've covered. You could send us case suggestions like we've asked for, especially from those smaller New England states. And yeah, we appreciate you being here and we appreciate you guys listening.
And with that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Goodbye.